This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is Catherine Herridge. She's a national correspondent for the Fox News Channel and is the author of the brand new book, The Next Wave, On the Hunt for Al-Qaeda's American Recruits. And Catherine, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for your time.
Greg, thanks for having me.
A lot of this book is focused on a man that we have heard about mostly in the wake of the attempted airplane bombing in Christmas 2009, as well as the Fort Hood massacre, which occurred shortly before that. And that is Anwar al-Awlaki. He's kind of supplanted, certainly since bin Laden's been killed, but even more so, it seems like Ayman al-Zawahiri as the guy who's really kind of pulling the strings, and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is kind of taking the lead in doing this. How did he elevate himself to doing this, especially having been born here in America?
Well, this guy, al-Awlaki, is really the leader of what I call al-Qaeda 2.0. This is the new generation of American recruits, and al-Awlaki is a digital jihadist. He is someone who uses our technology against us. So whether he's emailing or blogging or Skyping, he's kind of like the Facebook friend from hell. He uses all of that social networking to spread this ideology of hate. And since 9/11, he's been unfortunately very effective at reaching out and inspiring Western recruits. And what we see here in the United States is a case of homegrown terrorism every 2 to 3 weeks. And in almost every case, there's some kind of a link to this cleric in Yemen. They're followers of his blog or of his emailing or his lectures on the web.
Is there anything we can do to stop the dissemination of his ideology?
Well, the problem with the web is that once something is up and out there, it becomes very difficult. You just can't get rid of it. And this is really not an accident either. In 2006, the al-Qaeda senior leadership really made a policy decision. They understood that U.S. law enforcement and the intelligence community were looking real heavily at people from the Middle East, Afghanistan and Pakistan. So they said, okay, we're going to change the picture, and we're now going to go after Americans and Western Europeans with clean backgrounds and clean passports, because we understand that it's very hard for U.S. law enforcement to put their own citizens under the microscope. So that's kind of one level where we saw a big change. And then this cleric al-Awlaki, being an American, understanding us, understanding our systems, has really been able to capitalize on that.
You have a very compelling quote from one of your sources in this book saying that terrorists follow the path of least resistance, kind of like water. They're a thinking enemy. So in addition to using our technology against us, what is it about their message that either appeals to people who they might not even know but share perhaps certain sympathies, or other people you might not even think would be sharing their sympathies?
That's an excellent question. Right around 9/11, the U.S. intelligence community believed that you had to have one-on-one contact, in-person contact. It was kind of like the mentoring thing for people to cross this threshold to violence. But what we see now is, unfortunately, some people are able to do it virtually. And the information I lay out in the book, it's somewhat anecdotal, but I do believe that there is a generational divide, and that people in their early 30s or under connect virtually through social networking in a way my generation, older generations, just do not. And they're able to cross that threshold to violence through the internet, through this virtual contact. It's no accident that Major Nidal Hassan, the accused shooter at Fort Hood, had this sort of extraordinary email relationship with Anwar al-Awlaki. People reach out to him to validate this extreme point of view. And we're talking about a sort of the margins of the population. But when you start to see a case every 2 to 3 weeks here in the United States, a decade ago, we never saw those numbers, and we never imagined that we would see homegrown terrorism inside the United States, and that's what we're looking at in the future.
Catherine, talk about the evolution of the homegrown threat a little bit more, because in the wake of 9/11, obviously, we had cells like Lackawanna, and more recently, as you point out in the book, we had the attempted Times Square bomber, Jihad Jane in Pennsylvania, and other folks who it looked like the FBI had a pretty good track on well before they were planning to put their plot into effect. But when it comes to the Times Square bomber and some others, it looks like we may have gotten lucky, for lack of a better term.
Unfortunately.
What's the real story of how well we're at least sniffing these out if we can't stop this terrorist communication?
Well, I think there's a mixed picture. On the one hand, we've become much better at sharing intelligence and unraveling these big plots, sort of the 9/11 style the plots, and we become better at identifying people who are traveling overseas to get their training, like the Times Square bomber last year, Faisal Shahzad, who tried to, well, he actually successfully drove that SUV into Times Square and thought he had a viable explosive device inside that car, but fortunately for us, he didn't quite have the recipe right when he went to Home Depot. But we do see a large number of cases where we've really been lucky. I recently learned that one of the reasons the underwear bomb was not successful is because it was damp. It didn't detonate properly because that young man had been wearing it for 18 hours and had been sweating a lot. I mean, that's just not a national security strategy, is it?
It certainly doesn't seem that way. So in the wake of, I know, Fort Hood, there's been a big controversy over how the government has classified that attack. A lot of the members of Congress from that area, Congressman Carter in particular, have been very upset that they won't simply call it terrorism. Right. What's the government's strategy in not doing that, and how big of a deal do you think it is?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I lay out in the book, and I just want to say the book is not an Inside the Beltway book. Hopefully that will reassure people. It's really a book that I wrote for people who don't live inside the Beltway, and I kind of take the reader along with me, and we connect the dots together in this investigation, and I think people will be really shocked and angry at what they find. The Fort Hood case, you know, to me, why did it take the White House 2 months to call it an act of terrorism? I mean, if it wasn't an act of terrorism, was it a convenience store shooting or a drive-by shooting? I don't think so, and it's my own opinion that I don't see how you deal with this problem until you call a spade a spade. And I would add that the White House only called it an act of terrorism in what's called a background briefing for reporters, which means that you're on a conference call with someone at the White House, and you can't even identify them by name. You have to use the term senior administration official. And if you don't agree to those ground rules, then you're not on the call. So they only called it an act of terrorism 2 months after the fact on a background conference call. And I just don't think that does us any service in terms of fighting this problem, and I don't think it does any of the victims a service either.
And Catherine, in our last couple of minutes here, as you look at Al-Qaeda 2.0, how do you expect future threats to emerge? Will it largely look kind of the same way they have in some of these recent attempts, or will the technology and other aspects of this have us searching for other things that we haven't been searching for in the last decade?
I think the sort of the rising threat centers are really going to be Somalia and Yemen. What I lay out in the book is that these countries, the Al-Qaeda affiliates there, have been very successful in recruiting American citizens. And I predict actually Yemen may be like Afghanistan on steroids in the future. There's really no central government anymore. It was on the verge of becoming a failed state. Al-Qaeda in Yemen, the group that was behind these last two major plots targeting the United States, is able to take advantage of the security vacuum there. And there's now new evidence that they're trying to work with the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia in a global way to do more global operations. And U.S. officials have said to me they're concerned that with bin Laden's death, these affiliates will try to step up and fill the vacuum, and we don't have terrific intelligence in that area, or we'll see sort of homegrown jihadists, these lone wolves, step up around the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and try and do something individually in the name of bin Laden. But I think the bottom line is that the threat picture is far more diverse today than it was a decade ago. A decade ago, Al-Qaeda was a Fortune 500 company with bin Laden as the CEO, and it was really easier to deal with in many respects. Now it's Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, traditional Al-Qaeda. It's the affiliate franchise operations in Yemen, Somalia, and North Africa. And then it's this wild card, the homegrown component. Oh. I mean, getting inside a conspiracy of one is virtually impossible. And I don't mean to paint too negative a picture, but what I'm just trying to say to people, and I really feel it because I'm in a military family and my husband's been deployed to Afghanistan, the threat picture in the future is going to be more diverse. It may, in some respects, be harder to fight because we find more Americans. And just because bin Laden is dead, that does not mean it's the end of the story.
Last question before we let you run, Catherine. In terms of the way the government is handling this, you certainly were on top of the story of the Peter King-led hearings in the House Homeland Security Committee, talking about how terrorists are recruited within prisons and mosques and other areas. Obviously, it engendered a whole lot of controversy, saying it was profiling and singling out a certain segment of society. But based on your coverage of those hearings, are they getting to the bottom of things, or is it more show than substance?
I think Congressman King deserves a lot of credit for taking on these issues very publicly, and he's certainly taken a lot of heat for doing so. Just last evening, I broke the story that his committee has launched a formal investigation into this cleric in Yemen and whether he was actually an overlooked key player in 9/11 itself. The facts of that I lay out in my book. I think it's extraordinary that we're a decade out from 9/11, and when we look at this American in Yemen who's now become sort of the public face of al-Qaeda in the West, that we really still have not gotten the whole story on that plot, and I hope Congressman King and his committee are able to do so.
Well, certainly very sobering, but important for Americans to know that the threat is very much still there and very real and very close to home, much closer than most of us realize. It's also an extremely well-written book. It reads almost as a novel, in addition to the fact that it being all truthful as you walk us through, as you said, over
the
past
compliment.
Couple of years. A very interesting read, and I commend to anyone The Next Wave on the Hunt for Al-Qaeda's American Recruits. Catherine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'd love to come back sometime. Great questions.
Thank you so much. Catherine Herridge, national correspondent for the Fox News Channel. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.